CEU Medieval Radio, Past Perfect, the talk show about medieval and early modern culture.
Hello and welcome to Past Perfect, CEU Medieval Radio's podcast on everything medieval and early modern. My name is Michał Mohalski and I am joined here today by Christine Antenhofer. She is a professor of medieval history at the University of Salzburg, with her research interests including history of emotions, gender, and material culture. She is a member of European Academy of Science and Arts, Fonds zur Förderung der Wissenschaftlichen Forschung Board, and the director of the Interdisciplinary Center for Medieval and Early Modern Studies at University of Salzburg. Christina, it is a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me here.
When we think about Middle Ages, our thoughts almost automatically turn towards things: crowns, gowns, relics, and heavy illuminated books. More often than not, these elements remain for us just costumes and set dressings, recognizable but not in focus. What can studying those objects tell us about their owners and their world, and how did it become the object of your own historical interests?
Well, my first focus when I started studying the Middle Ages were not the objects. I was fascinated first of all by letters. So I studied correspondence between various princes and princesses of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. And in these letters, so many objects were mentioned that my interest started turning towards the objects and their meanings. Because very soon I realized that these objects told me more about the emotions those people had for each other than many of the very stereotyped words they would use in their letters. So as you said, I'm interested in the history of emotions and in history of relationships, first of all, between human beings. and so this interest turned me towards studying objects as they really like agents or actors. If we talk in the thoughts of Bruno Latour, they part of these networks and they help to shape emotions, feelings, relationships between people, not only in the past, but even in the present.
Yeah, so you mentioned networks between people and objects. Do objects create networks between each other? So do they create meanings between each other?
Well, of course they do. I think colleagues would have different opinions on whether the objects themselves really produce these meanings or whether people studying these ensembles of objects then try to figure out meanings between these objects. But these are certainly different approaches to material culture. And so I always have to point out that I am a historian, so my focus are always human beings, first of all, and then the objects. I'm not the very materialist among historians or art historians or archaeologists, who often have more interest really focused on the materials themselves and the relationships they create between each other. But to give you one example I am really focusing on, if we usually or very rarely we just have one single object, but we very often encounter objects together with other objects, for example, if they are stored in a chest. And so I am really interested what we can learn if we take these objects in the whole context and try to figure out why these objects were stored in the same chest and what this can tell us about past lives.
So you mentioned letters and you mentioned chests, and obviously with those kind of groups of objects, what proves very, very helpful are textual evidences like inventories or letters. So how do they factor in the study of relationship between people and objects?
Well, again, this is a question of what is your personal approach and expertise. And I am a historian, so my expertise is not the material of the material culture. Other experts are way more experienced in working with remaining objects of arts or relics. So as a historian, I am able to really dig deeply into the written sources. And as you know, only a very small number of objects from the Middle Ages actually survives, but we have thousands, millions of objects that survive as written objects, as I always say, in texts, be these literary texts or administrative texts, like, for example, inventories. These are really like past museums where you can understand a lot about objects, how they were described, how they were grouped together, and very often you also get to know what happened to these objects. And this really helps to bring them back in their context.
I was wondering if we can turn towards discussing two specific examples by the inventories of two late medieval women, Paola Gonzaga and Bianca Maria Sforza. But before we start, can you briefly tell the listeners who were they?
Well, Paola Gonzaga, I think, is certainly less known. She was a princess from the northern Italian court, the Gonzaga in Mantova, which is near Verona and Venice, just to give you an idea. And she married in 1476 the last count of the county of Görz, Leonhard. Görz, Gorizia, was a medieval county that was situated between today's Austria, Slovenia, and Italy. So a very interesting part of land that never really got into becoming a real land and was later inherited by the Habsburg and became part of the Habsburg monarchy. So Paola Gonzaga married Leonhard, and she traveled in 1478 from Mantova to her new home in Lienz, Castlebrook, which is situated in today's eastern Tyrol. Bianca Maria Sforza is more famous because she was the second wife of Emperor Maximilian I of Habsburg, and she had a similar destiny, I would say, like Paola, since she also traveled from a northern Italian court, Milan, to a court situated in today's Tyrol, Innsbruck.
At the first glance, their marriages were similar, arranged at a similar time, with rulers not of similar standing, but ruling in a same geographical area, and they traveled from northern Italy to the courts north of the Alps in contemporary Austria. But were the objects that they brought with them as they were entering this new phase of their life similar, different?
Well, I think these two women are good examples in many ways because, as you said, we can compare them on a structural level, even though Bianca Maria Sforza was of higher status as she married the future emperor. But still, both women were certainly not married for love, as modern people always want to know. But who really was married for love in the Middle Ages? That would be another podcast. But it was, of course, their political impact, but above all, their financial power. And this financial power was expressed on the one hand in terms of their dowry, so the money they would bring with them. And both husbands, above all Maximilian, would spend the money of his wife also to finance his own wars, for example. However, they also brought these objects, and that is something that's very interesting because it's more typical for the Italian marriage system that women do not only get financial dowry, but they get objects. And these objects count to the financial value of the dowry. And that is why in Italy or in medieval Italian city-states or princedoms, inventories were compiled to record all these belongings, and they were regarded as part of the family heritage. So they were not just the women's personal objects, but they were really a part of the heritage of the family. So the families would also write down in the notary instruments that the objects would have to come back to the family if there would be no children, for example. So I think just this gives you already an idea that we are not only talking about objects and what they can tell us, but we are really talking about assets that are of financial value, and not only financial, but also dynastic value for these princely houses. So, of course, these women had similar objects, and these objects can be organized in different groups relating to spaces. And that is what interests me also as a gender historian, because these spaces are related to spheres of action and they tell us something about the agency of these women. Because women needed representative objects like jewels to perform on certain occasions. And if they did not have these objects, they could not enter these spheres of actions.
What spheres were they?
Yes, the typical spheres, as you might know, the female apartments that were not private rooms, as we cannot really talk about privacy, but the women would welcome guests there. They could have political talks and everything. So these female apartments, one important sphere of action that is sometimes located between something we might call more intimate spaces, where they would also have the children and welcome guests after childbirth. Very politically important moments that could not be overestimated how important they were. Then we have, of course, the religious sphere, for example, the court chapel, which they would adorn with their objects. And these objects would also display the heraldry of their own families. So in bringing these objects with them, they really could express political meanings in very important settings. Then we have the whole realm of the table, meals, not only necessarily in the castle, but even outside, for example, where, again, representation happens with welcoming guests to share meals and converse there. Then we have another big field, and that's the field of traveling and the representation of women when they enter cities or when they travel around a country and can display their political power in these settings again. So these are the main spheres of action we can find in nearly all of these inventories.
And what kind of objects are we talking about here? What are the most popular ones?
Well, that's a more difficult question because you can have hundreds and hundreds of objects from the most precious to the most humble ones. So I usually always say maybe the most symbolically important object for all of these women is the crown. You have already talked about the crown. So they have these crowns, they wear them as brides, and we find these crowns in their inventories. And maybe on top of the inventory, you also have the bridal dress that is also very special dress. And on the other end, you have something like sewing needles, so thousands of needles. And what really fascinates me when I work with these inventories is that I always look at all objects. I do not single out certain objects, but I really want to get the whole range. And what I'm also interested in is, of course, then to find out the blanks. So what does the inventory not record? And why? And is there an explanation? Because the inventories do not record all the things these women had. Usually they only record those items that really counted to the financial value of the dowry. So this is a very interesting example in the case of, which differentiates Paola Gonzaga and Bianca Maria Sforza. Paola Gonzaga had a whole little library she brought with her to Castlebrook, and so many historians would think of her as a very cultivated Renaissance woman, which is true, but she certainly was not a humanist. She was no poet and she did not write besides letters. Bianca Maria Sforza, on the other hand, has no books mentioned in her inventory. So this was, again, often interpreted as a lack of culture, which is not true in her case, because we know of many surviving codices that can be traced back to Bianca Maria Sforza. So in her case, it was just the fact that these books did not count to the financial value of her dowry, and so this is why they were not recorded in the inventory.
What do inventories of both of those women tell us about the life they had and the one that they expected to live as they were getting married?
Well, inventories are tricky, so you have to really get familiar with this source in order not to misinterpret them. In fact, these inventories, do not tell us everything we would like to know. And they certainly do not tell us what really happened to the women. You need other sources to contextualize the inventories. But what I found out when I compared these inventories, I'm convinced they can show different expectations that were attributed to these women's lives. And my argument is that they were structured differently. So usually when you put down the list, it's not accidental. But I don't know, when you go on a travel, on a journey, you maybe record the things you will take with you. And you usually start with the most important ones. And at the end, you have the things you even forgot, and so you noted them later. So just by looking at the hierarchy of the structure of this inventory, you get an idea of what was more important, which things were more important than others. And this structure differs in both cases. Both inventories start with jewels, which is like, this is the most important for women, not because they like jewels, but because jewels are such important representative objects to display power in the public. But then we have two different systems. The Paula's inventory goes on with objects relating to her body, her clothes, even her underwear. Then we have the textiles of her female apartment. And we have a whole bunch of things that I would call her personal items. So Paula Gonzaga's inventory starts with jewels, as does Bianca Maria Sforza's, because jewels were the most important objects in terms of being able to perform on a public and representative stage. But then the two inventories quickly differ, because Paula's inventory goes on with objects related to her body. So we have her clothes, we even have her underwear, we have different textiles for her female apartment, and we have a whole group of objects, of very small items even, I would call the more personal belongings she would use in her free time, for example, like a chess play, and very interesting other items she would use to clean her teeth or her ears, so things she would keep close to her and use maybe every day. And only after these objects, we then read the representative objects like silver for the chapel, silver for the table, and then finally the traveling items. And Bianca Maria Sforza's inventory is really structured in the opposite way. So this inventory also starts with jewels, but then we immediately have the silver, the representative silver for the chapel and for the table. And then we have paraments, so textiles to adorn rooms. And only after these items, we come closer to her body. We read about her clothes. And at the very end, there are some personal items, but not so many as Paula Gonzaga had. And as I said before, she also did not have a library. Paula even took art objects with her. So these items totally are missing in Bianca Maria Sforza's inventory. And at the end, we then have again traveling equipment. So why is this the case? So these two inventories reflect two different contexts back at the home courts of the two princesses. Paula Gonzaga was really cared for by her mother. Her mother and her sister-in-law put together this trousseau on the blueprint of other bridal trousseaus that were prepared for other Gonzaga women. So, of course, they were interested in the political importance of this marriage, but they also cared for the well-being of Paula. And so we find all these objects that somehow tell personal or intimate bonds. And we also see that for the women in this family, culture was a big asset. So they gave culture a huge importance. Paula did not only get books, but she also had utensils for writing letters. And writing letter was really a key way of education at the Gonzaga court, which had a very famous humanist school established by Vittorino da Feltre, where boys and girls were educated together. And the princely family would always encourage the children to write letters in their own hand. And so this really tells us a lot about this cultural focus, but also the personal bonds. At the core of Bianca Maria Sforza, we have a totally different situation, because in fact her father had been murdered, most probably with her uncle Lodovico il Moro being involved. And there was a whole political crisis at the background of this marriage. So there, for sure, we know her mother was at the court then and was in touch with her. But this whole trousseau was put together by her uncle and her brother. And it really speaks a language of power. And Lodovico il Moro married his niece to the emperor, really, to be finally recognized as Duke of Milan. So this was absolutely a different context. Yeah, we are missing this female handwriting somehow of a caring mother, but we know that she gave her other objects, which, however, are not recorded in this inventory. So again, you see, inventories do not only tell personal stories, but they are highly political and they are deeply rooted in dynastic dynamics at court.
Out of curiosity, you've mentioned that we know about different objects that were given but are not in the inventory of Sforza. How does the haunting, to use that term, for those objects that are not in the inventories looks like for the historian of objects of material culture?
Yeah, as you say, it's a tricky quest to find such things. One thing is, for as I said, books usually are, it's more easier to trace them back to their former owners. So this is one way that you can relate books to people, and even if they are not recorded in an inventory. And then, of course, you have other writings, such as letters, where maybe, if you are lucky, we get to know that somebody sent gifts to the other one. And so we get to know a lot more objects that are only recorded, for example, in the inventories. And they help us to reconstruct other objects, even, for example, food objects that were exchanged, food parcels that, for example, were sent from Mantua to Lienz. And you would never know about these food gifts if you would not have letters that record them.
And finally, as last question, do you have any object out of both of those lists that you find particularly interesting?
Oh, yes. As I said, I think I was very intrigued by these hygiene items, such as these utensils for cleaning teeth and ears in the inventory of Paola Gonzaga. So these are very interesting objects. And in the inventory of Bianca Maria Sforza, you have a lot of perfume pastes, so even boxes made of perfume pastes. And in the beginning, I was not even able to understand what this meant until I found papers by other art historians that really talked about these interesting objects made of perfume paste. So that's something I'm very interested in. And the other thing I have not said so far, and I need to say it, what's the most surprising aspect for me when I studied these inventories, it was the fact to find out that both, or brides generally, did not use all these objects for themselves, but they used them to make gifts to other people. So these trousseaus are not stable, no static luggage for their own lives, but they are really a kind of treasure they can use to make again social bonds by gifting objects to other people.
To forge a new bonds in a new place, in a new marriage. Great. Thank you very much coming here, and I hope to see you again.
Thank you. I hope to see you again too. Thanks.